Brown here again with A Lens a Day, conversations about information architecture. Today, I get to talk to the marvelous Rachel Price. Rachel, thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's get right into it, Rachel. We're talking IA, and you deal with very big, complicated IA problems. I imagine you have to engage a lot of stakeholders as you are working through some of these IA challenges. The way I've been starting these conversations is trying to get insights into how people do IA in different circumstances with different kinds of stakeholders. What do you find the most effective way to engage stakeholders or subject matter experts in the IA process? What resonates, what do you find resonates well with them? What is the turning point in the process where they kind of go, this feels very abstract, to, oh, I understand what we're trying to do here?
Yeah. So I think the first part of that, that I always talk about transparently with everyone, whether they're an IA trying to figure out how to do it or a stakeholder, is acknowledging that doing IA is 90% education, 10% execution, right? Like, if you measure doing IA as like what you ship, you will be constantly disappointed. And so for me, I've learned to adjust kind of everyone's expectations that a lot of IA is about learning something, understanding something, which is, when you put it as understanding something, I feel like that's not shocking given the names of places like the Understanding Group or like a lot of the work we do to like alignment, understanding all that stuff. So that's like the big hurdle that I try to get people over, especially in, you know, a culture steeped in shipping things, like we are at Microsoft and at most tech companies, right? It's all about what you get out the door, the artifacts you create. And that mindset shift takes a while. And how I get there, and the thing that I found really resonates with people, is if one time I can facilitate somebody through a difficult conversation or a hard workshop or a bunch of boxes and arrows on a whiteboard, if one time I can facilitate someone through that, so at the end of that session, the little ball of anxiety and fear that they walked in with is relieved, then I've got them. You know, like, that is rewarding on a human level. And it's also like, that's the buy-in, right? I had a mentor once who said, you know, back when I was consulting, one of our jobs is to like relieve anxiety. I think it was actually Mike Monteiro talks about this in one of his workshops, right? Our clients come to us with these hairy balls of anxiety. And really, if we can just like take that from them, be like, here, like, I got it. Then we're proving our value. And I think that a lot of that anxiety comes out when you're doing IA work, because I talk about this in a lot of my talks, like, humans hate ambiguity. And what is IA work? Like, what is doing IA? It's reducing ambiguity, right? It's like making meaning. And so I think that anxiety wrapped up in the idea of ambiguity and not wanting to tackle it, like, we're a very special breed of people who actually like tackling ambiguity and who like cleaning it up and tidying it up, or who are not afraid to kind of step in there. And so when you can be someone's shepherd through the ambiguity and get them through a tough situation to where at the end of it, they feel a little bit better, like their stomach doesn't hurt quite as much when they think about the project or whatever you're working on, like, that's the buy-in.
And even if you've only moved the needle a little bit in terms of their anxiety, they've come to see you as someone who can help with this process, right?
Yeah.
So I feel like it sort of starts to create that forward momentum because they know you are there to work with them on this and not just merely judge them or whatever.
Right. And I think sometimes we can get in these situations where people are coming to us for answers that we don't have. And at first, you know, when I started doing this, I was like, ooh, I have to have all the answers. I always have to know and like take them in the right direction. And I think if I can acknowledge, like, no, I'm actually just a shepherd here, I don't have to know the answers, and they come knowing, like, I don't have to know the answers. We will find the answers together. It's like, there's so many kind of parallels here. I'm thinking about one is like, you know, the service orientation of being a librarian, right? Like, for those of us who came through library sciences, like, this is very much like a reference librarian service approach, where you're like, I don't know the answers, but we can certainly figure out how to get them. Yeah, it's like, I can point you somewhere. I can help you negotiate the query so we can find the thing that'll finally answer this question. I can help you untangle the question. And similar to, you know, the way IAs, designers, researchers end up in this kind of inadvertent counselor mode a lot, for better or worse, right? It's dangerous territory to be in, and it can be really sensitive, but you end up in this place where people are coming to you in pain and in discomfort, asking you for help, asking for answers. And so I employ a variety of tools to help people kind of walk through that ambiguity and try to make sense of things. And I think to give like a bit more of a concrete answer than just my, oh, like, be the shepherd, it's all great. You know, there's lots of things we do. Like, this is so silly, but Sarah, I work closely with Sarah Barrett, who's another IA, and she has this catchphrase that now everyone says, which is like, post-its are cheap, right? And so one of the activities we do, which has really picked up during the pandemic, actually, is like using a digital whiteboard with post-its and like making people just like put things on the wall, right? And we say, if it's not on the wall, it doesn't exist. So you can't just say it. Like, let's get it out and like get over that fear of getting your thoughts into a place where you can start to structure them and move them around and draw lines between them. You know, giving people that safe space to practice, right, that kind of thinking. You know, it can be really silly little activities, like just put it on a post-it, like just try putting it on a post-it. Or it can be really like intense activities where we have these highly contrived workshops of all these different facilitation techniques, but like whatever it is that gets the people to practice wading into the ambiguity is a tool that I think can be really, really valuable in getting buy-in and getting people to trust you.
That was awesome. I think there's also something to be said for part of being a shepherd is being a role model in confronting ambiguity. And I sometimes see myself as being the person out in front, embracing the ambiguity, not letting it scare me, so that, you know, I'm putting stuff on the wall.
Yeah.
So that other people might put stuff on the wall, right? So that it's almost like I'm kind of shouting, like, I'm not afraid of you, ambiguity, and none of us should be afraid of you, right?
Yeah. Bravery is such a huge part of this.
Right.
I feel like I keep name dropping this because, like, I really want to credit people for these ideas. Like, a year or two ago, Abby Covert did her keynote, and I think IA conference or World IA Day, I'm not sure which one. Anyway, and the ultimate theme of it was bravery and like being brave. And she was talking about kind of her own career journey. But that really, like, I watched that and my whole brain lit up, because I agree about the career journey and all the applications she has there, but also like at work and at your projects and being that role model for people. Like, it is really hard to decide you are going to confront a basic human fear, right? Like, our brains are wired to vanquish ambiguity, right? Because if you can't tell if that thing is a lion or a rock, like, you kind of want to know which one it is, right? We're both glasses wearers, so I feel like I have like a very deep appreciation for this need to know from far away, like, what is that giant hulking object? My brain has to map meaning onto it, or I'm just wildly uncomfortable, right? And that's like this hardwired trait. And so to be the person who's going to say, you know what, I'm going to confront that, I'm going to go up against that, and I'm going to show these other people who are my peers, who are my superiors, who do know me and who don't know me, or who are paying me lots of money to like get them through this, I'm just going to walk right up to that thing that I don't know if it's a lion or a boulder yet. And I'm just going to hope it doesn't swipe at me. And we're going to get through it. And like that requires a lot of bravery. And I think that's a really good point you make. And I also don't want to make light of it. Like, I think that's why, like, there are days, this job is really, really hard sometimes.
Let's dig into it a little bit. Because I appreciated you a moment ago, just getting more concrete with some of the tools that you use. I wonder if you and I, a couple of IAs who like categorizing things, could classify the ambiguity. Like when we say ambiguity, what do we mean? Because I feel like there are lots of kinds of ambiguity, but is it a special, what's the word I'm looking for? Species of ambiguity that we are engaged to confront?
Yeah, I feel like the easiest one to start with is semantic ambiguity. Like I'm thinking of when I'm on a feature team and we're building out some new feature on docs.microsoft.com, right? There's some new offering for our users. There's eight people in the room who all have probably a different imagination, different idea of what the experience is going to be like, how it's going to smell, how it's going to feel. If you could touch it, what would it be like, and all these things. And until we talk about that and come to agreement on the semantics of what we mean by whatever the feature is, we can't really move forward. But most people don't want to take the time to talk about that, the semantics of like, when I say page, does that mean what you think page means? You know, when I say test, what does it mean to you? So like, to me, that's kind of that's a gimme, because I feel like we spend a lot of time talking about semantics in IA and like how we're like really set up to tackle that. I also think though, I don't know the label for it. I'd have to convene a subcommittee to really, you know, get into the label for this, but like, there's also ambiguity around like the solution itself. Right? Like how we're going to create this experience. I'm trying to think of a concrete example there where, you know, if you want to put together some sort of like interactive wizard, right, to help someone figure out where to go on vacation, right? There's all sorts of ways we could solve that problem depending on what subject matter expert you're talking to, right? And like how much work you want to do, what capabilities you have in the system. And I find that that is another area where people get very uncomfortable spending time, like breaking down that ambiguity because it feels like a time suck. It's complicated. If it gets too complicated, what does that mean? Is it too complex because the idea is complex, or is it too complex because we're over-architecting it? My trigger word. Which I am guilty of, I will fully admit. I over-architect a lot of things. Like, I don't know what kind of ambiguity that is, but that's a lot of, it's like the ambiguity of the work itself that I find our IAs are constantly shepherding people through.
Is that because there's no reliable or repeatable process for doing IA? Is it a process thing? Or is it that the nature of a solution when we're in the IA space is, again, not a, there's no, what, inherent consistency between them?
Yeah.
Like there are IA patterns, but it's not enough for us to sort of be able to point to them and go, it's this kind of thing.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's like, it's because we don't have this well-formed thesaurus of like, oh, it's this kind of problem, therefore we solve it this kind of way.
Right.
And I think part of that is like probably every field is up against us in some way, and that like every problem is a little bit different, right? And there's cultural expectations for like breaking stuff like not doing, like not repeating a pattern, which is like a little painful to me, you know, and you're just like, why? Do you have a good reason for not repeating it?
Shouldn't we use something that works?
Right? Yeah. Or like, you know, like you said in the intro, not to brag, we do deal with like really complex IA problems here. Like we're working at a huge scale. And the more complex a problem gets, the more complex the solution gets. The less thinking you do about how to simplify the goals, right? Like if you go out and say like, oh, I'm going to do this like really this amazing thing for users and it's wildly complex and it's going to be so cool, right? Like when you avoid the conversation about narrowing that scope down, mm-hmm. and like, wait, what's the simplest thing we could do to address this need? Then you get into these solution spaces where the solutions have to be really complex to support the complex promise that you made to your stakeholders. And then when you have to be in a conversation about complex solutions, then suddenly everything feels too hard.
Right.
And now you don't want, no one wants to deal with it because now your stomach hurts again.
So speaking of stomach hurting and nobody wants to deal with it, this I feel like is a good segue into the lens that you chose. Why don't you tell us what lens you chose and maybe describe it in your own words?
Yeah, so I was like dancing around this and I was like, when am I going to say the words metadata feasibility? So I chose metadata feasibility mostly because, not because I'm an expert and I have great answers about this, but it is a constant challenge that we're coming back to on almost all of the work we're doing, whether it seems overtly about metadata or not. So when we're working in complex structures, we're doing these complex experiences, and we always have to be asking like, okay, but how can we bring this to life? Like, how can we support this? And generally that comes back to the assumption of good metadata. And this is kind of what I was getting at in like the category of ambiguity about like, how do we do the work? Like, how do we solve the problem? What I was really foreshadowing there, I think, inadvertently, is we make a lot of assumptions about what we can do. And I find that one of the most pervasive assumptions we make is about metadata and what we have and what's possible, because there's often a really big gap between what's possible, like what's theoretically possible to capture with metadata. I mean, this is where IAs and taxonomists and like anyone who works on knowledge graphs, ontologists, like, oh, this is like our happy place. Like, let me map the entire body of human knowledge into a knowledge graph. Oh my God, that'd be amazing, right? Like there's this theory of what's possible. And then there's the question of like, what's actually feasible in the context we're working in. And this is a tough pill for a lot of stakeholders to swallow, including me, right? Because often when we're thinking about huge piles of content, huge amounts of data, complex experiences like TurboTax, right? Like, we have these ideals of how the world could work and how machines could help us do our jobs better using that are based on these assumptions of how metadata is strung together and based on these assumptions of experiences having semantic understanding of human knowledge so that I can replace the reference librarian with a chatbot, right? But for the most part, those are assumptions. And I think in rare cases, those assumptions are true. You have the capability to have that kind of metadata. But in most cases, you know, we end up having to come back to the drawing board and say like, okay, what metadata do we have? What metadata could we have? Like really, really reasonably, what can we expect from the human beings who work on this team? Not only what they know about the world that can be mapped to metadata, but also like, you know, the work of actually implementing all that stuff. onto the content, and then the work of actually stringing that metadata from the content to the experience is supposed to pull it all together and recreate, you know, a sales agent in the field or right. something. So that's, I chose that because like, it's a lens that we have, you know, a 5-person IA team to deal with.
Which sounds big to a lot of people, I would imagine. But given the scale of the information that you're working with is probably
infinite. There's not enough of us.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, we're constantly like, we need more help. But I mean, who isn't always saying right. that?
And there, I mean, I would imagine that you've got people saying, just how many IAs do you need? And how many IAs, aren't there like all the IAs in the world?
Yeah, they're you? Like, aren't you like 20% of them? No.
So, I loved just how you characterized everything about that, because I feel like you were saying things that made me realize or that sort of brought to my head that creating a metadata framework has a promise, right? There's sort of this promise, this ideal state of how we want the world to work is how you put it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't displace or it doesn't eliminate work. It just moves the work to a different place, you know, and that work is tending to this garden, this sort of overflowing garden of metadata that is required in order to make all of the cool, elegant experiences work.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel like it's hard for people to make that leap between, all right, well, yeah, maybe you're not, you know, doing a ton of curation on this side, but you have to move that work over to curating the metadata. How do you communicate that with, how do you help people understand what the real impact is of changes or modifications or enhancements to a metadata framework?
I'm chuckling because I think now's a good time to turn this into a help hotline for me. If anyone has an answer to this question, please call me.
Yeah, I put it out there just so you could get help.
Yeah, it's really hard. As you were talking, I mean, the big thing that came to mind for me is it's like turning into a meme in my world, right? Of like, oh, just ML will do it. Just give it to the AI, just give it to the machine learning. Like that'll figure it out.
Right.
And, you know,
it's goes well.
It always goes really, really well.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to find a good way to explain that to a technologist who is super smart, super capable, of like how the gap of like the machine can only learn if you teach it something. So we have to teach it. And just because content exists out in the world and is on the internet doesn't necessarily mean that it is in a good enough shape to teach, you know, an algorithm or whatever. And so I think that that's really the challenge, is what you've come down to, is like illuminating the fact that, so there's assumption like metadata means the machine can do it, whatever the machine is. But the fact is like someone has to create the metadata, like a person
right.
still has to create it. Not all of it, right? Like you can get auto tagging systems going and like check it, but like someone has to start it, someone has to seed it, someone has to check the work, someone has to spot check, you know, if you're using any sort of like automatic tagging or auto classification system. This all still requires a human being, and at the scale of most large repositories of information, it requires more than one human being. And that human being also needs to tap into subject matter experts who are also human beings. You know, there's this whole network of people behind it, and I'll be transparent in that. I think like that's been a really, really hard case to make,
right?
Is that there are still humans behind the metadata, regardless of how automated things seem on the surface.
Right. So one of the things that I've been asking folks about is helping designers who may not be as steeped in information architecture, helping UX folks who have not done as much IA as you have. How do we help them apply this lens? So if you were coaching someone or needed to offer someone at some advice on looking at the work that they are doing through this lens, what advice might you offer them? How might you coach them?
So one thing that we do every time we work through a new feature is we do a lot of content modeling, and we borrow a lot from Sophia's object-oriented UX process. And as part of that, when we do the content modeling and we kind of identify the content types and the parts and pieces of an experience, one of the questions we ask is, what assumptions are we making of the system about this page or this object or whatever? And so one question that I put to designers is, okay, you've got this robust page with all of this stuff that to me looks like tags, right? Tags that I know we don't have, right? So then I get to say, okay, what assumptions are you making here? Like, let's circle the assumptions together. And then let's unpack each of those assumptions. And then actually go check to see how much of that assumption is viable. Because like, I'm a skeptic. I'm always like being like, yeah, we can't do that. And like, sometimes I'm completely wrong and we totally can do a thing. And so what I find is that if you can get a new designer below the surface level of just like, oh, well, like, look, there's pills and the pills are clickable and they have a word in it. And that word is the name of a product. Okay, like, let's unpack, like, who's going to put that there? Are you going to handwrite the name of, like, dumb questions? Like, are you going to handwrite every single one of these pills? Like, oh no, the system will do that. Okay, where will that come from? Well, I don't know. We have to know that. Do we know that? Hey, engineer, do we know that about this content? And they get to say like, no, or like, yes, actually we do, you know, and doing that unpacking. And I feel like, you know, I say that as if it's like this really fun activity for everyone to be involved in. It's not. You're adding complications to their lives and you're slowing them down and making people uncomfortable. But that's so far like the best way I've found to do it is thinking about like, under the surface of this interface, like what strings are you actually implying are being pulled?
Nice. Rachel, that was awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
What an interesting, complicated topic. And I'm so glad that I got to talk about it with you. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This has been great.